This is Neelan Parker in the Ministry of Commerce building in Monrovia, Liberia, and I'm here with Ms. Frances Johnson Morris, who is the former chairperson of the National Elections Commission in Monrovia, Liberia. If I could just begin by asking you about your role in the 2005 elections.
My role in the 2005 elections was very key because I was the chairperson of the National Elections Commission that had been restructured.
And maybe just a bit about your background to give a sense of where you're coming from.
Well, the background is that I'm a natural-born Liberian, and I am a lawyer by profession. Before coming to the Elections Commission, I had held other very important positions, i.e., transitional chief justice. Who I presided as a chief justice over the Supreme Court in 1997. That court was constituted to actually decide electoral disputes, if any were to arise. Fortunately, we did not have any significant case arising out of the 1997 elections in which Charles Taylor was declared winner. Immediately before I came to the National Elections Commission as chairperson, I did human rights advocacy with the Catholic Justice and Peace Commission, which is a very prominent, I should say, the forerunner of human rights organizations in Liberia. I headed that immediately before going to the National Elections Commission.
If we could just begin by discussing a little bit the goals and objectives of the National Elections Commission in 2005.
Okay, in 2005, the goal and objectives of the National Elections Commission was obviously to we considered, first of all, that body, the National Elections Commission, was a special body. I can say that it was one of the strategies for conflict, for the resolution of our conflict, of our 14-year, conflict. It came out of the Accra Comprehensive Peace Talks in Ghana. There, the warring factions, the political parties, civil society organizations, converged in Ghana, Accra at the time, to try to find a solution to the civil conflict that had brought the country on its knees, literally. And so one of the ways to solve this situation was to postpone elections that were due in 2003 and to rather have elections in 2005. And The parties to the agreement thought that they needed to restructure the Elections Commission itself, because as it was constituted at the time, there was not much confidence, in the body by the parties. So that's how the National Elections Commission, the commission is constituted in the it's established. It's created by our constitution. It is simply called the Elections Commission. But for the purpose of the 2005 elections, the parties, they modified the name to National Elections Commission with new members to conduct the elections. And so the dominant purpose of that National Elections Commission was to conduct credible elections, which the parties did not feel could be held in 2003 under the ESPOR Elections Commission, ECOM. So that was clear, that in order to solve the problem, in order to bring an end to the crisis, in a sustainable manner, credible elections needed to be held. And so they came home and decided to restructure the commission, nominate new persons to it. Number of persons were recommended by the various interests, various factions, including civil society. And I'm told that over 40 names were recommended to the then transitional chairman, Charles Julie Bryant, because each stakeholder had their own nominees, civil society, political parties, human rights and pro-democracy groups. So that's how the commission was carefully restructured to ensure that it carried out that mandate.
What would you say are the biggest challenges that arose in that election environment?
In that election environment, some of the biggest challenges included we had a problem with logistics. We had a problem with, trying to deal with all of the international stakeholders, all of the parties. You had the international contact group on Liberia. You had the ECOWAS. You had AU. You had EU. You had the United States. You had the UNMIL. And there was a time that, it was not quite clear who was to do what. Because UNMIL felt, and other part and other stakeholders felt, that elections should have been conducted by UNMIL. But we found out later that UNMIL had no mandate to conduct elections. In fact, when I was being inducted, I had read the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which is called the CPA. And I gathered and I interpreted the CPA to mean that the National Elections Commission was to play a very important role, as opposed to what was being speculated and then being interpreted by some of the other stakeholders that, no, the Elections Commission is not to play, it's just to be there as a ceremonial. We said, no, the CPA, the agreement gives the Elections Commission the right to organize elections, to conduct voters' registration, to conduct civic education. And these are, by no means, these are the essence of holding, of the conduct of elections. So how can someone say that, the Elections Commission is not to, it's just there, but it's UNMIL. Anyway, we crossed over that hurdle, and it was determined that the Elections Commission, the national body, had to drive the process. And so we did. And the question of, the logistics, the resources to conduct the elections had to be shared among the various international stakeholders, as well as the national government. Sometimes it was difficult. Some of the support that some of the stakeholders had pledged were not timely, they were not forthcoming timely enough, and we ran a risk of, sometime we thought that maybe elections had to be postponed, because if people are not coming in with their commitments, we were very jittery at times, the public was there looking, citizens, everybody anxious, and sometimes taking onto tax and indicting us for not, being forthcoming with voter education, civic education fights. And, timelines were tight. We had to have the elections on October 11, 2005. And then there were challenges, there were, problems with political organizations, political parties, complaints and disputes. Luckily, we had a dispute resolution mechanism in place. Firstly, as prescribed by the elections law, somebody having a complaint could first come to the commission to be adjudicated, and if that person was not happy, any party that was dissatisfied could go to the Supreme Court. So it was quite clear. And we had a couple of those instances where we had to, Supreme Court had to intervene to determine some issues. Some party felt that he was not given enough opportunity, maybe, to process his papers. And, you know, but these things went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court played its role. It will play our role. So that was, dispute resolution mechanism is very important in the electoral, you know, context. Because if people have challenges, if people have concerns, there must be a forum where they can go to get redress. And we saw that, you know, it played itself very well during the process.
Yeah. Speaking of resourcing and resources not arriving on time, what sorts of things did you do either to get resources to come faster or to deal with the fact that resourcing was a variable problem?
Well, we had to talk to the stakeholders, to those who had, you know, promised. We had to talk to them. We had to tell them the importance of coming, of being timely with the assistance, with the resources, because the election, we had to hammer it down that the elections were time bound. And if anybody thought that we're going to postpone elections, there would be a breach of the violation of the CPA. And we were determined, we were resolute that we're going to keep the timeline, you know.
Do you have any other recommendations to someone who would be in your position for how to deal with internationals?
Well, internationals, yeah, you know, because that's a very important, you know, usually post-conflict societies, you know, really impoverished. They don't have the resources, the kind of resources needed, because if you want to have credible, fair and honest and free and fair elections, you must, they're very capital intensive. You must have the resources when they are needed. You must do conduct your civic education timely enough so that people get the message, so that you, people get interested in the process. And so you have to talk with the, you know, it doesn't pay to be confrontational. You must let the stakeholders know the importance and the risks we run by not doing, you know, coming forth on time with their statements, with their assistance and commitments. So you talk to them and let them know and inform the public about why this is not taking place now because of this and that, and make sure that also the national government will step up to the you know, place if somebody, just in case, defaults and does not come through at all. The national government must be there. And our national government really, you know, came up, stood up to the challenge, you know, and sometimes they bailed us out while we were waiting for our internationals to come forth.
How long did the electoral process take from first planning until the final count?
Huh?
How long was the electoral process?
Okay, we started the whole real process and the work, the implementation around early 2004, you know. Okay, let's see. We were, by the middle of 2004, because we were inducted in April 2004. Yeah, the parties to the peace talks came back in 2003, August 18, they reached the agreement, and then it came, and then we were, you know, the transitional chairman was installed by October 2003, and so we came in 2004, by April. And so from April 2004, to just about September, you know, ending. I mean, because there's always something to be done up to the last minute of the conduct of the elections. There's something to be done. So it's not that we completed our work and we're sitting down and waiting for October 11, 2005. No. We work just up to the, you know, the very end, the last day before elections.
And how was the decision process, or what was the decision process to produce the final schedule for the elections?
Okay, again, a lot of consultations. We had to have consultations. We had to have, we developed timelines for each activity from this time to this time. Remember, I think voter registration, for instance, was from April something to May 21st, about 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks, about that. But each item, each activity had a timeline. And that was done with consensus by the, not just the international and government, but the, all the stakeholder political parties involved. We all sat down and we, you know, came up with some of these, and they gave their input. Sometimes, oh, this time is too short for this. But, you know, at the final analysis, we had to, you know, make the final decision as what was, you know, important and what was reasonable, you know, bearing in mind the deadline.
Do you have any general advice to offer people in similar settings about the timing and sequencing of elections?
Okay. My advice would be that the timing and the sequencing of these activities must be made clear to all those involved, to all the stakeholders, to all political parties. And when you make a timeline, you must stick to that timeline. My experience is that we did not shift our timelines. If we said this time is from this time to this time is voter registration, that was it. We closed at that day. We did not add or subtract. People had to know ahead of time, you know, that this is the time you have for this. This is the time for political party registration, for instance. By this time, you must have submitted all of your documents. You must have registered. You make timelines. Make sure stakeholders have enough opportunity. They have full knowledge of about it. And then you stick to that timeline. You don't shift them, you know. Don't waver about those kind of decisions. Yeah.
Describing how the NEC was established, what other options or models were considered in the negotiations to create or to overhaul the NEC?
Well, basically the decision to overhaul the NEC was done in Accra between the political parties and the warlords and all those who went. So we didn't have much to do with, you know, they felt that they could not have free and fair elections with the system that was then in place, with the composition of the commission as it was then. So what drove the decision, I'm not, you know, the other considerations, I'm not sure.
How would you now, or after the restructuring, describe the relationship of the NEC to the government? Generally, people feel elections management bodies should be independent, but there are different ways of establishing that independence. What are some?
One thing I can say about the National Elections Commission, who were truly independent, and I've said that to people in the society over and over, I say if there's one thing that can be said about the former chairman of the National Transitional Government of Liberia, he never one day interfered in our decisions at the Elections Commission. He never one day called me to say, oh, you know, this and that, can you see how you can maybe extend this time or do something. He stayed out of it. He stayed out of the activities, out of the decisions of the National Elections Commission. You know, the National Elections Commission. I'm not sure about what happened in the past, but this one, he really, because maybe he did not have a stake. He was an incumbent, but he was not running. Maybe if he was running, it would have been different, I'm not sure, but he did not, he simply kept out of the, affairs of the National Elections Commission.
How would you recommend to others that they establish their independence under other circumstances, or even the current NEC that will have an incumbent who has a party that may run?
Yeah. Well, you know, during that period, we did some reforms, electoral reform, and one of the reforms is that the election body must be financially independent. So we created a provision in the electoral law to say that the elections commission must have financial autonomy. That means their budget is, they draft their budget, it is taken to the national legislature, and the national legislature approves it, and they get the allotment directly from the budget bureau, and their money is put in their own account. They don't have to run to a finance ministry every day up and down following vouchers and maybe encountering the temptation of somebody saying, oh, you know, you got to do this before I give you, you know. So that was cut off because we made sure we provided for that financial autonomy. And the body, you know, the commissioners must be independent themselves. They must resist any interference. There was a time when in the initial stage of the National Elections Commission when we took over and we were trying to restructure and, try to streamline the workforce in the Elections Commission. And, there were some attempts by the legislature to try to question us and call us to the legislature and question our decision to set people down and reduce workforce and we resisted that. And I wrote them a memorandum to tell them that this was inconsistent with the mandate of the National Elections Commission and with the intent of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which maintained the independence and the autonomy of the Elections Commission. So I told them, you know, we could not be coming here every day to come and answer why we put people down. This is lies within our prerogative to do so, you know. So you must resist interference.
Is there a NEC code of conduct?
A NEC code of conduct? We developed a number of codes of conduct. I know for political parties. I think there's a code of conduct for NEC.
What role did that code of conduct play, if any?
Well, I don't remember anybody challenging any of political parties and politicians will always attack the commission, no matter how, you know, credible you people try to be, because there were times they say, oh, this person is a member of this political party, and that's one of the rules. You cannot be a member of a political party and sit on an electoral body. You cannot, and so we try to uphold that. But what our constitution says and the electoral law says that if somebody is a member of a political party, because it's almost impossible to say that. No, you will find people who have never been members of a political party. I happen to be in that category because I had never been a member of a political party because I served at the judiciary for many years, and that's one of the prohibitions. You cannot be a judge and be in politics. So for me, it was clear. But there were some people who have been members of political parties, but the law requires that you renounce your give up your membership to that institution as soon as you are, you know, announced as member, you are appointed to the commission. So we kept to those rules. Those people who were former members of political parties, they renounced their membership to those parties, and they were published in the papers for everyone to see. And so that is something. You cannot have political, you know, leanings if you're going to be on the commission. And if you have, you must renounce and be sincere about it and let people know and see. Yeah.
Transparency is a very important part of elections.
Of course.
I'm especially interested in the ways that people try to maintain transparency in the NEC here.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that is very key to free and fair elections. And so we tried to be transparent by involving, by making the process participatory and inclusive, consulting with stakeholders at all levels on decisions taking, and having them also work along with us, especially when we come to key things like electoral districting. You know, we call them in and we all sat down and derive the formula to be used to demarcate the electoral districts. So in that way, you know, you can maintain transparency. And transparency was maintained through that process. People came. In fact, some of the parties volunteered to give us a formula about how to do this. And we all worked together and accepted the formula, and that's how we did it, by, you know, demarcating the districts in accordance with this population, this, that, you know. So when you involve people in decision-making, then you can uphold your transparency and your credibility. And I think we did that very well. You know, we consulted a whole lot. There were times political parties got tired with consultation. They said, oh, you know, we got our work to do. You go ahead and do your work, you know. So,
you know. Was the budget ever subject to public debate?
The election budget? I'm not sure it was subject, but everybody knew the budget. It was published that this is the amount that election is going to need. And people had access to that at the legislature, because it had to be, you know, people had to know what it took to conduct the elections. And that was published. That was public knowledge. In fact, when we first did the first formulation, people critique it. Some people say it was too much, and, you know, and then our international partners do with the technicians. They had done elections in other places, and they knew what it took. Literally every item, pencil, the cost of it, paper, you know, everything was spelled out. And so when the budget was finally, you know, announced, I think it stood at 80 or 90 million at the time, yeah. Everybody knew what the budget was intended for, how many workers you needed, how much the compensation for them, and just everything from paper to pencil was stated.
Could you tell me about a particular success of the NEC in the election of 2005?
Well, the particular success of the elections that I like to refer to is the opportunity given to all political parties, stakeholders, and the kind of interest that the NEC, that the elections generated. By, you know, I think people got interested in the elections because of the way we inform the public about the process, the way we encourage people to come out and vote. And because we told them the importance of voting and the disadvantage of not voting, because you're not going to have a voice. You know, whoever wins, if you don't participate, well, you're going to be bound by the decision that will be made. And a particular success was the overwhelming turnout of people, family. After we, initially they were kind of reluctant, but when we spoke to them, we educated them on the need to vote. We had projected about 3.5 million people that were eligible to vote. I think we got 3.2, which was marvelous in our view. You know, 3.2 came out to register to vote. The registration was really a great success. You know, I was, I were very, very, you know, overwhelmed by the way people came out and actually voted to vote, actually registered to cast their vote.
How did your leadership, either yours or leadership of other of your partners, mm-hmm. play a role in this elections?
I think let me speak to my own leadership. I think I have the fortitude and the will, the credibility. And I think people respected my leadership because even those that were criticized, they knew deep down, you know, I had built a reputation for integrity in my society, in positions, assignments I have been given. I have been very forceful, focused, direct, and sincere about what I was doing. Because nobody could say I was member of this or that, you know. And so I think that helped as much as the logistics and the resources and this and that. But they had to believe in the leadership of somebody. And I think that people, you know, even my critics, I would say, know deep down that, you know, that this, the chairman of the Elections Commission of 2005, you know, was somebody who had a reputation for credibility and integrity. So I think that helped. And also, my other able commissioners, you know, we came from backgrounds. Human rights advocates, peacemakers, like, for instance, pro-democracy activists, James Fomoya, Mary Brownell. These were names that people knew, and they respected over the years. You know, we had a former president of the Association of Female Lawyers of Liberia. You know, these were people who had been, you know, proven. And I think... that helped, notwithstanding, you know, a few distractors, but I think that's what drove the process. You know, I hate to say, you know, things about myself, but I have to, you know, say that, you know, really, you know, today people, every day people commend me, you know, and that's they commend me for my role during the elections, you know, in the society, whoever I meet. And that's the only thing they remember me for. Notwithstanding my human rights advocacy, the court, where I was at the court for those many years, but they remember me for the elections. And somebody said, in fact, in opposition, one of those major opposition, you know, the CDC, one of the officials met me one time and said, I'm sorry that you have to leave the commission. I'm sorry you have to leave the commission. And I said, wow, you can say that now? So, you know, it shows that, you know, when people are really honest and sincere about what they're doing, you know, it shows, you know. And you can take the decisions you take and do the things you do without any, you know, a fear of criticism because you know what you're doing. You know, what I focus on is on the public interest. I don't care about individual interests and things. What I do in the interest of the public. And that is the guiding principle that I take to everywhere I go. You know? That the public interest is above and superior to individual interests. You know, we need to save the society. We have to have these elections to make sure that we bring an end to war and don't revolt. To war, so we have to do it to the best of our ability and in the most credible and transparent manner that we can. And I think we succeeded in doing that. I think we did.
I would call that a great success. You mentioned the budget and you mentioned some of the issues of trying to get finances in a timely manner. Mm-hmm. Do you have any ideas of how to make the electoral process less expensive to conduct next time?
Well, we believe that we had thought that if people do continuous registration, as it were. Continuous registration. As people become eligible to vote every year or every month, they appear and they do, and elections commission record them and register them. Rather than waiting for elections year and then you want to register 3.5 million people, you know, it's difficult because we did not have that kind of system in place. We didn't have the records when we came to election. So we had to do a registration for practically everybody anew. So, but if you do continuous registration every year, people turn 18, they can go to the elections commission in their district or county and register. You know, it makes it would be a lot easier and less expensive because that involves a lot of logistics.
In terms of staffing, how were staff members recruited?
How were staff members recruited? Yeah, you know, we had a lot of partners, a lot of international partners. The voters, the poll workers, many of them, we made announcement that Onmil was basically in charge of that, going and making announcement for poll workers to come. In fact, the poll workers actually signed an agreement with the peacemakers, with their Onmil, because they were paying them directly. That was their part of contribution, to pay all election workers, poll workers, not election workers, poll workers. And so the announcement was made. It went from county to county, announcement was made. People would come and sign up. They would come. They took tests, you know, to be vetted. And they had a certain criteria set. We all developed the criteria. At least you must be a high school graduate to be able to participate in this process. We developed the criteria for qualification to work as a poll worker together. And then they signed the agreement eventually with these people. So, you know.
Was the staff size adequate for this election, in your opinion?
It was. In my opinion, it was.
What kind of?
I think we had over 18,000 people working. 18,000, if my memory serves me right. Yeah. At least 5 persons to a polling station. You had the registrar, you had the assistant registrar, then you have the recorders. I think about 5 to each polling station. And we had about 3,005 of those things.
Mm-hmm. Were there any kinds of skills or any area that had a short supply of staff?
Let's see. You know, actually, when many of these people, when they were recruited, most of the workers, they had to go through a little training. So they were trained. They were trained by our partners, you know. So you were trained how to mark a ballot. You were trained how to, you know, they were trained in various skills in the various areas of the electioneering.
So. And in your view, how adequate was the training that the partners, and by partners, you mean UNMIL and IFES,
all the part. I think it was, you know, relatively adequate because, I say this because we did not have very huge, the margin of error was very minimal. The margin of error was very minimal, so it means that the training when it was effective, it was adequate enough. Because there were not a lot of spoiled ballots, you know, margin of error was very minimal.
How were staff members who worked some distance from headquarters monitored?
We had commissioners. The commissioners were divided. They were given regions. The country was divided into regions. For instance, I had oversight responsibility for Monserrato County and Magibi County, and I would make tours. On election day, I would go around. When they were having training, I would go to supervise and see whether everything was being done in accordance with the rules. So 7 commissioners, the place was divided into 7 regions. And each commissioner had oversight at least two counties per person.
What steps were taken to protect poll workers and any NEC staff from threats during the election and before?
Well, you know, Onmail was in charge of security. And we agreed that an Onmail person with police officers would be around the prison. Not in it, but around, a little distance away to, you know, make sure that they, you know, tackle any issue, any instance of violence or anybody who want to come and disrupt the process. And so I don't remember receiving any report that some poll worker was manhandled or brutalized by, you know, one or two instances of some ex-combatants disrupting election in Nima County. In Nima County, because, you know, they have a lot of fighters there. But that was taken care of by Onmail, you know. Yeah. They threatened that no election would be held here if we do not get our pay, if we do not, you know, just scare tactics, you know.
Speaking of payment, how were field staff paid?
Huh?
How were field staff paid?
The field staff? They were paid, how much were they paid?
How were they paid?
How were they paid? Oh, okay. They were paid after you complete your work and you carry your record. You sign, an army person will be there. They had a place where they would go and sign up for their payment and then, you know, and move on. Yeah.
How did you protect field staff, not from threats, but from influence of other groups like political parties, for example?
Well, again, you know, we had to depend upon those who had oversight responsibility. And we asked people to bring complaint to us if they found any of the workers in activities that were not, you know, that undermine the integrity of the process, you know. That was for sure. And we consistently talked to, record them and had a meeting with them. I will, you know, basically preach to them about the need to guard, to safeguard the integrity of their particular elections. I told all of them, you know where we are coming from. Coming from a very difficult period. It will mess these elections up. If any action on your part will impinge upon the integrity of the thing, then you know, what that's going to mean for us. So we call upon them to, you know, try to not, you know, get involved in those kinds of things. There are many people to monitor, actually. You know, 80,000 workers. You know, all of them. You know, but I think basically, many of them did their job, you know. It was not perfect, but again, like we say, it was at least 80%, you know.
In a NEC, the leadership is, as we mentioned before, very important, but the human resources generally are very important. How is it that you maintained and promoted qualified or good staff? Do you have any recommendations?
You have to pay them well. You know, this process, that we say transparency, credibility is so important. If the elections are not credible, you know, then the whole exercise would have been in vain. So what you do to motivate them, that our workers were paid more than the ordinary civil servants. They were paid in hard currency, U.S. dollars, whereas other people were paid in Liberian dollars. People were making $250, $400, you know, just to make sure that they were not tempted by, you know. Yeah. So they must be paid well. Yeah.
Speaking about donors and working with the UN.
Are
there two or three mistakes that you commonly observe in the way that donor countries or international organizations act with relation to local personnel?
Yeah, you know, one of the first one I can, you know, they always assume that the local personnel have no capacity. They have no intelligence, so to speak, you know, and they don't have the competence to do anything, and that they bring in everything. They bring in competence, they bring in expertise, and whereas there are local expertise, you know, and the 2005 election will prove that, and we have local expertise. This idea of, you know, there's nothing here, everything, you know, they don't know anything, it's something that is should be discouraged. When you come, you seek out the however minimum, get those that are, you know, competent and have some expertise and use them. Why would somebody want to come to a country and bring lawyers as if they say there's no court system? And if there's a court system, that means there are lawyers. So you look for the good ones and try to use them. And don't assume that, you know everything. Because first of all, this is a new context to you, a new environment. When you come in, you have to learn the you have to learn the context, you know, in which the people operate, the environment. You have to know about it. They assume that there's no capacity. They assume that they impose strange practices on the local people. They assume that there's a one-size-fits-all solution to every post-conflict situation, which is not true because there are different cultures. You know, you don't assume that. You have to come, every solution, everything must be context specific. And you don't assume that, you know, because you did this in East Timor or somewhere, so the same solution will fit here. You don't assume that. That's dangerous. Yeah.
In your line of work, is there any aspect of UN policy or management, or donor policy or management, that you think works better now than it used to?
Come again, say that.
Is there anything about the way that the UN operates, mm-hmm. that you think, or donors operate, that you think is better now than it was before?
Yeah, I guess because we're out of the woods, so to speak, and things are back, things are returning to normal, things are working again, and so right now I think they are more willing to sit and listen than before. You know, they are more willing to sit now and listen and work along and ask the population and ask the people what their needs are, rather than assuming that they know their needs, you know.
If you could offer your successors, I asked that one previously. What are the biggest challenges you think the elections management body will face when the country must conduct elections on its own?
Well, the biggest challenge will be the finances, the resources, because like I've indicated, election business is very expensive. That would be the first challenge I would have. Right now, the Elections Commission, the National Elections Commission, they've been conducting by elections literally on their own, and they've been successful. So I think that they will manage, you know, but the resources, will be the biggest challenge that they will face. Because if they want to have the same kind of elections of 2005, they got to have all of those things in place, that we had equipment to do voter registration. They will have to have the resources to do adequate education, voter education, public education, printing of ballots, and those things are expensive.
What technical assistance or other support that you received would you say was most helpful and why?
Okay, what technical assistance we received was most important? The technical assistance that was very much important, of course, is the equipment, the materials for the conduct of the election itself, the physical materials. You know, rules. We could develop rules. We did that together jointly, but when it came to procurement of the logistics to actually do the process itself, that was very, very useful, very important. We got all of our logistics on time when it came to the elections, got the ballots printed on time, we got the vehicles, mobility was available to take them to the various counties on time, by helicopter, by, you know, whatever means it needed. That was in place, and that is very critical. That is very critical, to have all of your needs, election materials, and the kind of equipment you need. You need vehicles, you need, you know, all of these things to travel throughout the country to deliver on time.
And final question, if you were providing advice to someone in your position working mm-hmm. in similar circumstances elsewhere, mm-hmm. what would you tell them?
I would tell them that we need to plan. Plan well, plan properly, do a lot of consultations with stakeholders. Take decisions and be firm, don't waver about decisions that you take. And what else? I would tell them, make sure that your character is above reproach, to have the moral authority to, you know, preside over this election. Work on your character and your integrity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your
You're
time.
Welcome.